Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody. This is Janine. And you are listening to Politics Done Right. All Coffee Talk internet radio shows are part of the Coffee Party Be the Media project. If you'd like to join our team, go to www.coffeepartyusa.com/volunteer. Be the Media. So, as you can probably tell, I am not Egberto Relays. I am guest host Janine Loudon from Lunch with Loudon. And with me today is a guest co-host, Pim Vanahay of the Pim Vanahay Show. We hope you'll be adding your voice to ours today. The call-in number is 646-929-2495. We only have a little bitty hour for a great big topic, so please don't be shy. Dial in and hit the number one on your phone so you can raise your hand and participate. I hear you, Tim. Would you like to say hello?
Janine, and it's a delight to be here, and it's an honor to be able to, both of us, to cover for Egberto on his show. He does such a wonderful job, and I'm just glad that we get the chance to do it.
Oh, me too. He's got wild and crazy callers and guests, so I'm looking forward to this team of listeners, if you will, schooling us on TPP. So, today, of course, if you've seen the info, we're here to discuss the Trans-Pacific Partnership and this week's passage from committee of the TPA, the Trade Promotion Authority, which is better known as Fast Track. So I think I should start with just a moment of full disclosure, which is I do not support this free trade agreement. And I'm going to give you just a couple off-the-cuff reasons why, and maybe that'll give you a place to start. But one, I do not believe in the secrecy that has clouded, shrouded this agreement from the very beginning. Way back in 2012, Peter DeFazio, my representative, was stomping his feet in Congress about how big business had access to the language of this agreement, and while at the same time, members of Congress did not. We'll just talk about the general notion of secrecy there. Number two, I have no reason to believe, I have not been shown any reason to believe that this free trade agreement will work any better than NAFTA. And NAFTA was heralded as a big, it was supposed to be good for consumers, it was supposed to be good for workers, it was supposed to be good for America. And it just turned out to be good for the quote-unquote economy, but we're talking not the Main Street economy, we're talking about the Wall Street economy. So the most conservative estimate was that NAFTA cost us over 100,000 jobs, and the least conservative estimate is that it cost us 1 million American jobs. And so there you have it. The third reason that I don't support it is that even with the diligent efforts of my Senator Ron Wyden, this fast-track agreement is a review but not amend. Review and vote, no room for amendment. So this project, if you want to call it this economic project, only embraces a yes-no vote. There is no ability to alter, amend, modify, nothing, which I find very interesting. So I'm concerned. I'm concerned that this move is moving along. I'm concerned that in this pre-election frenzy, it's not terribly, terribly easy to know where people stand, where candidates stand, let alone where our current elected stand. So I see people in the queue, but no hands up. So I'm going to open Tim's mic, and we're going to keep talking. So the one of the things I think people need to understand, if you don't already, is that the TPP involves 11 countries in addition to the United States. So in the Americas, that's the U.S., Canada, Mexico, Peru, and Chile. In Asia, it includes Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia, Brunei, Japan, Singapore, and Vietnam. Now, by the way, if you have no idea where Brunei is, it's this teeny tiny little oil-rich, natural resource-rich piece of Asia, a little tiny slice, and it's not unlike the Kuwait of the Middle East. In other words, it is so resource-rich, fraction, such a part of its complexion as a nation that everything is paid for by the government, from the oil and, you know. So anyway, this tiny little Brunei has oil, and apparently that's its ticket into this agreement. All right, I see a hand up. I'm looking forward to finding out where this conversation is going to turn. I want to know about TPP and Fast Track. So area code 620, I've opened your mic. Welcome to Politics Done Right. And you have barking dogs. Can you do anything about that?
Hello.
There you go. Hi. Who are we speaking to today?
Is it me?
Yes, it's you.
Jack.
Jack. I bet you have 10 fast words for us about this.
What?
I said, I bet you have 10 very important words to say about this. This is a good thing.
Yeah, okay. To my speaking, is it... okay. TPP we're talking about, right?
You got it.
Okay, I'm against it because I think we're... because of the trade imbalance, it's going to go against the United States. Unions are against it. Environmentalists are against it. Unless you can figure out a way to where you don't have the trade deficit result of the trade deficit, we have about $300 billion deficit against China, I think, and Korea. We did Korea, and it got to be a negative two, and that's when we traded with South Korea. Used to have good trade. And so it started with NAFTA, with North Mexico and Honduras and Central America what else?
You gotta
figure out a way. Where the laws I hear are not going to be, the problems are not going to be settled for years.
Hey, Jack?
Yeah.
Hey, Jack, this is Tim, and you brought up a really important point in your comment there, and that is Korea. We just have a fairly recent agreement with Korea, an Asian nation, to make a number of arrangements, and many promises were made with that agreement. And you are right to point out that it has been an abysmal failure, and it has not created jobs. In fact, it has cost jobs. And I wonder why Congress does not use that as a canary in the mine shaft for the TPP. Why isn't that discussed in the course of this conversation?
Because I think they want to discredit Obama in every way in Congress, and but the Republicans are very much for it. I mean, what the Republicans are for, I am against in every way. It's going from what to do about Iran, and ISIS. They're doing nothing.
Well, Jack,
Jack's sort of thrown down the glove here. Go ahead, Tim.
Well, I want to be careful not to politicize this because there seems to be a total irrationality amongst both parties. I mean, to the many Republicans' credit, particularly the conservative ones, they are coming out against it. The Tea Party is not in favor of this trade agreement, and they are working together with the more liberal aspects of the Democratic Party. So I think we would be in error to paint a broad brush to politicize this. Perhaps, Janine, what we should do is I like the idea of staying with the principles. You know, I mean, the way I look at this is, you know, trade between nations should be a privilege, you know, between two countries that are trying to help their citizens. And a trade agreement should not be an overarching agreement that supersedes the national sovereignties, where we set up another layer of government, a layer of corporate government, which is in essence more powerful than the individual nations involved with the TPP. This needs to be part of the disclosure, and that's why we need to make sure that fast track does not happen.
Well, exactly. I think that it's an interesting issue to me, Tim, because, and Jack brought this up, but there are Democrats who support this. There are Republicans who do not. So I don't think that this is clear on party lines, but it is on economic, philosophical lines. And it is interesting that while we have a horrific history of free trade agreements, in terms of we still sell these things on the basis of our ability to promote, quote unquote, made in America, and talk about this as being a boon to consumers, when as though consumers were not workers or workers were not consumers, as though there's not a relationship between those who are able to make money and those who are able to spend money. And I always find this sort of a bizarre little do loop of logic. You know, how do we separate those? And especially, as you just said, the Korean agreements, canary in the coal mine. NAFTA, you know, how big a bird can you get in the coal mine? Seriously. I mean, NAFTA did not do anything as promised other than make Wall Street a lot of money. Right?
Well,
go ahead.
Well, in fact, NAFTA has done a lot of harm. And, you know, we can absorb some of that harm in the American economy just due to our size. I mean, we have lost jobs. But it has been absolutely devastating for Mexico because what it has done is allowed, you know, franchise food and big chain retailers and retailers to go into Mexico and overpower the local economies to displace people from their family businesses and local economies and has put them out of work. And made them, in essence, have to work for the new American major multinational corporations, which have set up operations in Mexico. The Mexican people have rallied against it to hundreds of thousands of people rallying against this. This does not get coverage in the U.S. media, but it is widely unpopular down in Mexico. And I suspect that the Trans-Pacific Partnership will be equally unpopular around the world. And I would offer that, you know, even countries like Japan and China are preparing for its inevitability by gaming their laws now, so the United States will be at an even further competitive advantage should this be implemented.
Interesting point. We have another hand up. And so I'm going to bring in another caller, Tim. I believe that this is Greg Resick. Greg, are you with us?
I am. Hello, and good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for calling in to Politics Done Right. So I know that you have a few opinions on this issue.
I do, actually. I guess one of the first things I might start out with would be that it's the thing that I think has most people concerned right now, or at least what I think is probably one of the biggest concerns, and it's already been touched on, I think just by you a minute or two ago, and that is, you know, the idea of whether or not America should be able to continue to make its own rules, its own laws, and to make decisions around things like whether or not we should continue to have policies like Buy American. The chapters that have been leaked on the Trans-Pacific Partnership so far indicate by every definition that that freedom to make our own decisions will go away with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And this is where there's a wonderful opportunity for everyone across the political spectrum to really rally around and unify on if the word could just get out. And I'm referring to something called Investor-State Dispute Settlement. The acronym is ISDS. It's an abbreviation, an acronym people should get familiar with and understand. And what it basically says is that as part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, governments will have to ensure that their laws and regulations do not put any limitations around what corporations can do as part of this trade agreement. And essentially what that means is that the trade agreement now would then supersede whatever laws or regulations any one country might want to pass, and in essence really threatening that country's sovereignty. Now, people will say the ISDS has been around for a long time, and they'd be right. It has been around for a while. But what's different about the TPP is that it now extends that same concept to 9,000 new foreign-owned firms and 18,000 new U.S. firms. And what this amounts to, and this is where we really need our conservative and Tea Party brothers and sisters to understand, and that is what that means, is that a corporation like Philip Morris, who is suing Australia, I think it's Australia or New Zealand, over cigarette packaging labels, can sue our government, take our tax dollars away from us, if in fact a law or regulation is deemed by the ISDS tribunal to impede or inhibit their ability to make money now or in the future. What we're doing with the Trans-Pacific Partnership is ceding our rights as citizens and our government and its authority over to private enterprise. That, to me, is the crux of why the Trans-Pacific Partnership is so threatening and so dangerous, not just for us, but obviously for all the other countries that are involved. There are 12 of them, nine of which probably really don't make a hill of beans in the grand scheme of things. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, 12 countries, account for 40% of the world's GDP, but that's mostly us. The other countries, Canada, Mexico, Japan, yes, they add up a little bit, but Vietnam, Chile, these aren't nations that are going to have huge impacts on whether or not the economy or policy swings one way or the other. This is all about what is best for multinational corporations who know no boundaries, who know no patriotism, who have no allegiance to any of us, except for their shareholders in the bottom line.
Right. I'm not sure that Brunei is going to impact me a lot.
Well, here's how it will. Here's how it will, Janine. Here's how Brunei, here's how Vietnam, here's how Malaysia will impact us. They pay those societies and those countries have labor laws and environmental laws and regulations that don't come anywhere close to what the standards are that we have in this country, as poor as some of them are, those laws and regulations. If an organization can get its labor and destroy the environment in Malaysia, let's say, in the process of manufacturing some product or some other activity, You know, the giant sucking sound that Ross Perot talked about heading south with NAFTA is just simply going to be a bigger sucking sound going overseas. And here's the other thing about the TPP. Most of it, at least what's been leaked so far, what's understood about it so far, most of the, I think there's 29 chapters in it, most of them have nothing to do with trade, actually. There are very few trade barriers that actually exist among these 12 nations. It's not as if any one of them are tariffing the hell out of the other ones. This is not about trade. This is about eroding and breaking down the last barriers that exist between what corporations can do and get away with and what's best for people, what's best for societies. What's best for each sovereign nation to be able to decide on their own. That's what this agreement is all about, is removing perhaps, those barriers.
Perhaps more accurately. Yeah, well, no, Greg is bringing up some brilliant points. I mean, really, this is not a TPP. This is a CPP. It's a Corporation Protective Pact. It's just designed to protect multinational corporations. And we can bring it to light in a couple of ways. If Greg, and Greg, please correct me if I'm wrong, but suppose the United States were to pass a minimum wage law after the TPP is in force, and suppose we were to go to $15 an hour. Well, a corporation like an international corporation that pays minimum wage or pays Vietnamese wages would say, well, hey, America, before you raise the minimum wage, it was $10 an hour. Now it's $15 an hour. You owe us, taxpayers, $5 an hour for our lost profits. And so now what we've done is the taxpayers have come into a situation whereby we are subsidizing the corporations. Suppose a corporation is polluting, and we find out that they are polluting, and we pass more stringent environmental laws. Well, the corporation will not only charge us for the implementation, for the cost to comply with those laws, but they will charge us for the ongoing sustenance of complying with those laws. So it is a total forfeiture of U.S. sovereignty, and it is, like I said, it's a CPP, Corporation Protective Act.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's meant to ensure that what supersedes everything else that might happen here or in any of the other member countries, first and foremost, the priority will be what is most beneficial to the multinational corporations who would be affected by rules, regulations, laws that are either on the books already or may be contemplated and passed in the future. And, you know, for anyone who thinks that this, you know, this is some sort of, tinfoil hat hand-wringing, all you need to do is take a look at what organizations like Chevron are doing under very similar auspices. They're suing, I think it's Venezuela, for a couple of billion dollars after they were fined for polluting. This is the completely corrupt and perverse idea of what capitalism and free markets are supposed to be about. That an organization that does some kind of damage or it comes under some regulation can somehow now turn that around and make that a public payment that's made to them because of lost profits. The same thing happened with a fracking company in Canada who wanted to frack in, I think it was Quebec, who Quebec said, no, we're not doing fracking here. They're suing. In fact, I think they won that suit for a couple of $100 million. Now, here's the thing about this suit and these lawsuits is that they're not actually in courts. They're not in public courts. The trade agreement provisions for investor-state dispute settlement require the countries that are signatories to it to abide by the terms that are in that trade agreement, and that includes having these the ISDS tribunals, who, by the way, are staffed principally with attorneys from the same multinational courts they're supposed to be making decisions about. And those rulings are what's part of this treaty that basically binds the countries who sign on to it to abide by those rulings. That is the attack that is in place on our sovereignty, and it puts our ability to determine what kind of society we want to live in by limiting our legislators and then handcuffing us without any kind of redress or appeal for the rulings that get made by these tribunals. This stuff is available to be read publicly. All this information has been available by WikiLeaks, the latest chapter of it being the investment chapter that reinforces this idea about what ISDS really means. And that is a complete and total give up of our ability to make up our own minds about the kind of rules and regulations we want to live by in this country, and the same for the other 11.
Well, Janine, may I add something to this? It's kind of a story that pertains to the last time this happened. I believe it was the implementation of the World Trade Organization. And I told this story a couple of times, but I had the opportunity to have a conversation with former U.S. Senator Hank Brown, who voted for the World Trade Organization for this conversation. And whenever it passed, and again, the progressives and many people were up in arms against this thing, but it did pass. It went through the Senate, and it got the two-thirds or the majority vote that it needed. In fact, I think the vote was a landslide. And Ralph Nader, after it passed, he said, would any of the senators like to take a test about how well they know what's in it? And 99 senators just blew him off. But Hank Brown, to his credit, said, yes, can I study it? You know, and then we'll take the test. And Ralph Nader said, sure, that'll be fine. And so Hank Brown took the test, did outstanding after the fact. And he goes, and his closing comment was, my God, had I known what was in it, I would have never voted for it. And that's the situation that we are facing today with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. If our senators really knew what was in it, if there was full disclosure, they, as Americans, they would not vote for it.
Right, and still we keep it a secret. You know, still we're not, our elected are not able to read this document. And I want to add something. You know, I have a background in business. I have particular perspectives on the economy. And I just want to point to one little thing here. We say corporations and we say multinational corporations, but what we're actually talking about are wealth builders, right? These guys. And the corporations are nothing more than their airbag. They're a legal construct to protect them from the consequences of their own actions, right? And so I do get concerned when we fail to connect the fact that these wealth builders have the same kind of relationship to international trade as they do to our elected. In other words, if you follow the money from those guys to the elected, you sort of see this little stirring pot of mischief, right? I mean, what kind of think tank produces law that transcends law, right? A trade agreement that will now transcend American law, take decisions out of the courts and into tribunals. What kind of swirl is that? And I assert it's the swirl of money. It's the swirl of our elected being beholden to their fundraisers or their campaign contributors, who are the same guys who have all these airbag corporations and who are doing mischief on the world economy for personal gain. Now, I realize that's a stretch, but it's actually not a stretch at all. Comment.
You know, I tend to agree with you, except I don't want to call them wealth builders because that sort of implies that they have a constructive activity. I would prefer to call them wealth accumulators because that's what
that's what they're doing at this point. But the Chamber of Commerce, Tom Donahue, I believe, is the head of it. He came out with a comment, you know, pleased at how it's progressing and all these other. But even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce really is about 90% represented by only 64 of the biggest corporations. And so this is and these 64 corporations and individuals who are major shareholders and fund holders and so forth, they're the ones contributing to the politicians. What I would be curious, Janine, is how much longer do we, the people, put up with this? When does this show up in the ballot box? You know, if let's pick a name out of a hat. Let's just say John Boehner supports this. And I don't mean to pick on him individually, but suppose John Boehner supports this. He's up for election every 2 years. Do people simply continue to support him because he's Republican, even though he has this on his voting record? How much longer do we put up with it? What is the tipping point?
Well, I think that's interesting because I tipped over, fell off the cliff, and went down screaming a long time ago. And so I don't, it's like, I just haven't hit bottom yet. I don't know where the bottom of this is because this is a huge cliff. This is this whole notion that stuff can be so sneaky and so deceptive that the average guy on the street has to be some kind of political and economic sleuth to keep up with it, right? It's just, that's what blows me away. You know, this is clearly a workaround government. It's clearly a workaround the electorate, right? You and I won't see it have anything to say about it. I mean, one of the examples I read, and Greg, you probably can speak to this, is that Canada could actually be sued for controlling the cost of pharmaceuticals in their national health program, but you know that this law would actually enable that.
Right. So it's interesting you bring up pharmaceuticals, Janine. And let me just take a quick side trip here, very quickly, and actually very respectfully just disagree a little bit with what you were saying, and that is, this is complicated, but it's not impossible for us as citizens to be aware of and to be able to take action on. The fact that we're having this discussion today is evidence of that, for me at least. The problem tends to be, I think, is that there's not a high degree of motivation for our elected officials, and especially now at this point, the president and the U.S. Trade Representative, to be sharing much of this with anyone. The sunlight that would shine on this agreement if it was being made public would in fact reveal it to be something that lots of people would be concerned about if only they knew about it and if only corporate media would pay any attention to it. But none of those folks who are in control of that information have any motivation or incentive to make sure that the average citizen actually knows about it. So I'm gonna give props to Jason Assange and WikiLeaks and whoever is spilling these chapters to them so that we can know about it. And we should be paying attention to organizations that are paying attention to this subject for us. And there is a lot of them out there. I'm going to give a couple of plugs for some of my what I would consider to be kind of my go-to sources in a lot of this. Public Citizen is, I think, head and shoulders above a lot of organizations in terms of the kind of tracking that I think her name is Lori Wallach does on this issue. Others are Fight for the Future, Expose the TPP. There are there are a lot of great organizations doing a lot of good work trying to make sure that Americans pay some attention to what's developing. You know, it hasn't happened yet. And by the way, this is an agreement that has actually has its roots all the way back to 2002. We got involved right at the end of the Bush administration in 2008. And somebody made the comment, I think in the chat room, I'm not in front of the computer right now, that Froman, the current U.S. trade rep, is a friend of Obama's. So, yeah, the circles are kept nice and tight and close to the vest. So we're kept in the dark as much as possible. To your comment, your question about Canada and pharmaceuticals, Joseph Stiglitz was making a presentation not long ago. I caught it on YouTube. And the issue there with pharmaceuticals has a lot to do with intellectual property and patent protection. And he was really making some salient points that people should try and understand, and that is that it's one thing to have a patent and to be able to protect it and be able to make some money from it. I'm all for that idea. But from what I've read in the intellectual property chapter that's been leaked about the TPP, the idea now is to extend those kinds of patent protections to up to 75 years. Now, what does that mean in the pharmaceutical industry? That means that we won't in our lifetimes get generic versions of drugs that are coming out onto market at any time, you know, in obviously not for our lifetimes. I don't expect to live to be 150 or 200 years old, right? But, you know, a 75-year patent protection on a brand drug ensures that those drugs will not be affordable to the vast majority of the people who live in these 12 TPP nations, except for the very wealthy, and that's obviously a small percentage, because we all know that when competition actually comes into a marketplace, it drives prices down and makes things like medicine more affordable to more people. That's an ethical and moral objection that I have about the way this agreement is being put together. I don't dispute the idea that patents need to be protected. Otherwise, you know, there can be a stifling of innovation if somebody thinks I can't make any money, you know, and it takes a lot of money to develop a new drug. I get that. Bayer has to know that, you know, they're going to be able to recoup their investments and make some money later. Dirty little secret is a lot of that research actually comes out of academia first before it ever gets into the corporate labs for further exploration and discovery and monetization. But the idea that you would have a patent protection that would last essentially the lifetime of an individual born at the same time the drug comes out is ridiculous. That's excessive.
But it is ridiculous, and it's also sort of an illusion about how you pay back research. In my past life, I built research laboratories, and I built one not far from where I live now. And it after 10 years of research, actually fired the entire research staff because they could now ride on the profits of the product. So all right. The profitability now is strictly on the product. And, you know, 35 research scientists in a little community like mine are like out of work.
Because right.
This is so profitable. This is such a profitable market niche. And this particular lab dealt with viruses. And so, man, when they've got a product that works, they're in Fat City. And apparently, if this were to pass for 75 years, now, I know that there's been other patents that have sort of been, I mean, Mickey Mouse, you know, should have lost his patent too, but he didn't. apparently Disney had a lot to say about that. Betty Booth lost and Mickey Mouse won. But it is interesting, I think, to sort of, again, you used the term, and I don't want to fly over this one. You said you have ethical and moral objections. And one of the things that's supposed to be unique about this experiment that we call the United States of America and unique about a republic with a strong tradition of democracy, right, is that the people actually get to wrestle with ethical and moral objections. You know, whether it's, you know, this has the opportunity, the opportunity is being created again to sort of rule the world the way what the East India trade company used to rule the world. You know, it brought entire nations to its knees. it is mm-hmm. one of the key reasons why the United States of America exists, and it was certainly the source of the Boston Tea Party. And to not see how, for Americans not to see, how we're just launching this ship, you know, that is just like the thing we left behind in only, you know, only 250 years ago or whatever. I mean, this is so ironic. It's like, this is the stuff novels, this is the stuff science fiction is made of. And yet here we are, facing, empowering that kind of, giving that power to people who hold cash.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, Janine. And we seem to, at least over the last, I'm going to say 35 years principally, and most of that because that's what I'm familiar with, you know, is we have lost sight of the idea that the balance between private enterprise and representative government, the scale has totally been tipped to private enterprise. And far too many of our fellow Americans have bought into what I would civilly call the mythology, what is actually rightly called the lie of trickle-down economics. And this TPP agreement is the manifest destiny of that lie, that yes. somehow to benefit a corporation means to benefit everyone else, is an abject, unadulterated lie being told to people in this country, and some people continue to drink that Kool-Aid thinking that somehow a quote-unquote free market would somehow be best for everyone. And that's not only a lie, it's actually childish to even believe such a fantasy, that somehow corporations and the people who run them would do all the right things, because if they didn't, the market would punish them. That might have been true 300 years ago when your market was the community of 50 people that you lived with, but it's ridiculous on its face to believe that still in the 21st century. And for anyone to continue to support the notion that a corporation and the people who run it can be trusted to do the moral and ethical thing, it is just, it's incomprehensible to me how anyone can still believe that, given all the evidence that we have that exactly the opposite is what happens.
Well, right. Janine and Greg, let me ask you guys this, okay? You have a situation. Janine, Ron Wyden, if he votes
yes.
for it, and he comes up for election, do you vote for him?
You know, this is a real dilemma for me, because on 99% of the stuff he does, I'm so with him. And I do get, if you read between the lines on the thing that he released on the 16th of April, the statement about this, which you can find, by the way, on the event page for today's show, and on Lunch with Loudon, and it's been shared widely. Basically, it looks what he's trying to do is say, the TPP is inevitable, so let's try to put some controls on it. So he's trying to intervene at the level of, you know, will Congress get to vote on this? Will the public get to review it? Those kinds of things. But I think this is we are so outmatched to the level of, okay, we get an up and down vote. Congress can't amend it. It can only vote for it or against it, right? I'm terrified. You know, I'm terrified that, so regardless of what his intentions were, he did make himself a force to be reckoned with. People did have to give concessions to him, concessions in the form of what enforcement procedures were and all of that. But then again, I just go back to, you know, go ahead.
Well, those are non-financial concessions. He's looking for human rights type of thing. The key is, would you vote for him? If Hillary Clinton does not make a stand against it, will you vote for her? You know, I mean, where do we draw the line?
Same thing with Ron Wyden. Yeah, it's the same thing with Ron Wyden. I think it's a fool's errand to think that, I mean, it's like the most favored nation status with China. right? So everybody said, well, give them most favored nation status and then we can enforce human rights law. Well, that sure worked. So, I mean, it's like, all of this is, I call it boga rumba, and boga rumba is hysterical dancing to imaginary music. It's like what you do instead of boil something down to its essence and then pass judgment and execute, right? So we don't get to know the essence, pass judgment, and execute. So, no, if he votes for this, I cannot vote for him, even though I adore him. You know, I can't. I cannot vote for Hillary. I cannot vote for anyone that supports this because there's absolutely no intel out there that tells me it's going to help me, let alone America.
Greg, how about you? I mean, they're going to be dancing, you know, in the 2016 elections. They're going to say, well, yeah, I voted for the TPP, but don't forget about the Supreme Court openings that will probably occur. They'll probably point out some other issues, and they will do their best to run from the 2015 TPP issue. How will you vote for Hillary Clinton? Or would you vote for Rand Paul? Or would you vote for Green Party?
So, great question. I've never really considered myself to be a single-issue voter. I think part of the answer to that question would end up being, who's on the ballot? And that's really part of the question you're asking and part of the problem that we have here in the U.S., and that is that we are, for all intents and purposes, a two-party system. And without some significant campaign finance reforms, we're probably going to continue to be a two-party system. And while I've been a lifelong registered independent, and I have in the past voted for independent candidates, for Republicans and for Democrats, I don't think I would make my decision in the booth based solely on the TPP, but it certainly would be one of those issues that would influence me. If you're asking me what my opinion so far is of Hillary Clinton, I guess my opinion there is that she wouldn't be my first choice, but, you know, because I'm not a registered Democrat and I live in Pennsylvania, I don't get a voice in the primary, so I won't have much influence as to whether or not she shows up on the ballot. And, of course, I can't vote one way or the other for Ron Wyden. But I would say this about what the concession was that was made recently in the Senate Finance Committee. And I would encourage people, if you want to keep track of this piece of pending legislation or any other piece of legislation, I have found the website GovTrack, that's GovTrack.us, to be just a phenomenal resource. This particular pending piece of legislation is called S-995. Its sponsor is Orrin Hatch, and Wyden is the co-sponsor. It hasn't come out, and it hasn't even gone to the committee yet. The announcement the other day was simply that Wyden and Hatch, along with their buddy Ayn Ryan from the House Ways and Means Committee, have agreed to, in principle, to somehow put some brakes or some parameters around this version of Trade Promotion Authority, a.k.a. Fast Track. And supposedly what the Times reported was that they're going to put some kind of what I would call maybe poison pill measures into this idea that if the trade agreement does come up and it does not, in fact, account for things like Wyden wants, like concerns around environmental and human rights issues, then this fast-track authority would actually get pulled back, would actually get rescinded. At least that's how some people are reading it. That's how I'm reading what's been said so far.
But Greg,
so we're still a long way away. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, Greg, they also said this year was supposed to be the year of the 20-year NAFTA audit. It never happened. Okay,
yeah, right.
Remember,
yeah.
NAFTA was—it's not going to happen. If this camel gets its nose under the tent, the camel is in the tent. And really, when I asked the operative question of you and Janine, will you support the candidate? Is this the issue? And what I'm getting is. There are no consequences to the politicians who vote for TPP.
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far, at least not on my own behalf. There will certainly be consequences. What I will say to you, again, just relative to Pennsylvania as an example, is that one of my senators, Bob Casey, is actively opposing this fast-track authority. You can bet your bottom dollar he's going to be, he's going to be high on my list of getting a vote next time around, whereas Senator Toomey is on the opposite side. He's a staunch Tea Party Republican, and this is the part that just astounds me. It would seem to me that if the average Joe citizen, Jane citizen, who considers themselves to be a Republican, would understand what is being given up in terms of things like sovereignty in this agreement, their heads would explode. But they're not finding out about this. And I think, maybe it's finally going to come to a head, because the Republicans in Congress are far more in support of fast-track authority than the Democrats are. If you recall, last year, 125 Democratic representatives, maybe it was senators too, signed a letter to the president demanding more transparency. Not one single Republican in Congress signed that letter. Not one. So this is a partisan issue, and it needs to be cast on some level as a partisan issue. The fact that the president is pushing forward on this is mystifying, but maybe not so much when you consider that, at the end of the day, he is not really a progressive and certainly not a liberal on economic issues. He's just not. Now, somebody might say he's, found an ability to compromise and make concessions, but I don't see it that way. I don't see it that way at all.
But Janine, I know we're coming down to the end of the show, and you have a couple of announcements. Would you indulge me and let me read the lyrics from a Bruce Springsteen song that'll take about 1 minute? The song is "Death to My Hometown." It's a fabulous song, and the second stanza.
Yes, yes.
No shells ripped the evening sky, no cities burning down, no armies stormed the shores for which we died, no dictators were crowned. I awoke on a quiet night, I never heard a sound. The marauders raided in the dark and brought death to my hometown. And that's really what we're having. And that's what Mussolini anticipated, said the next revolution would be. He said it would occur while clerks sit at their desk, while factory workers stand at their factories, and it will be the corporate takeover. So it's a frightening situation, and we can need to continue to take action on these things. And I'm glad we have people like you and Greg and others deeply involved with this and trying to hold our politicians accountable.
Great last words for this conversation, Tim. We do have just a couple of announcements to make, and we have a few minutes to make them. So the first thing I want to bring up is that Coffee Party USA is planning what we're calling the April 2015 event. It's it's next Thursday. If you want to read about it, you want to sign up for it, you go to www.coffeepartyusa.com/April2015event. There's a Twitter storm coming, and there's a secret hashtag. And if you sign up, you'll find out what that secret hashtag will be. This is a very, very important event. Another thing I want to bring up, and I'll come back to you, Jim, is that Monday night, this coming Monday night, will be the Coffee Party USA Book Club broadcast. Do you want to say just a few words about that?
Well, we're going to be doing the book Becoming Madison, and what we're going to do, my understanding is we're going to be replaying a conversation I had with the author, Michael Signer, and it is absolutely fascinating about James Madison and the moderating influence he had to a very polarized group of founding fathers, and his techniques, his method to bring so many different sides together is a case study. I mentioned that it is to politics and political discourse as Sun Tzu's Art of War is to battle.
fascinating conversation with Michael Signer. Perhaps you've seen him on MSNBC. He's been all over the country promoting this, and we have a coffee party exclusive with him. And after the recording, we'll be available for a discussion about it. It should be a good evening. We hope you join us.
Monday night at, yes. What is it, 5 o'clock Pacific, 8 o'clock Eastern?
You know, I'm not sure. I'm kind of all over the board with all these time changes things. There are time things going on. But just go to the coffeepartyusa.com page, and you'll be logged into it.
Excellent, excellent. I want to remind you that there are many Coffee Party Internet radio shows. This one, Politics Done Right, normally with Egberto Willis, Saturday morning. Sunday morning, Bobby Rodrigo, I Take Liberty With My Coffee. Monday night is always our special events night. Thursday is Lunch with Loudon, my show at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. And every day you can go to danahay.com and listen to the Tim Danahay Show. So I want to thank Jack and Greg for being most excellent callers. I want to thank Tim for being the most excellent co-host. And I want to thank Egberto Willis for giving us a chance to talk about the subject. This is not over. This conversation is not over. And I think that you can look to those of us you heard today in Coffee Party USA in furthering the conversation about what this free trade agreement could mean to the economic life as we know it. And is this the direction that we'd like to go? So from everybody at Coffee Talk Radio, Coffee Party on.